Wondering if you should stay in Illinois or move out of state? Get your copy of Scott Tucker's book, Escape Illinois, Should I Stay or Should I Go? Get your complimentary copy at retirementdakota.com.
Investment advisory services are made available through AE Wealth Management, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth in for Steve Bertrand today on the Wintress Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us and spending part of your work day with us. We are most grateful to you. Hope you are enjoying the warm weather while it's here. I love this weather. I know everyone's kind of groaning and rolling their eyes about it, but I love it. I think it's lovely. And our February selves will thank us for soaking it in. So lots to do today on the Wintress Business Lunch. Let's get things started with our good friend, Dennis Rodkin, the residential real estate reporter from Cranes, Chicago. Always happy to see you, Dennis. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Amy.
Well, oh my gosh, we have so much to talk about today, but I think we should start with taking a look at June because there's lots to talk about with home sales.
Yes, home sales still good in June, but we have sort of lost the surge we were in April and May. Things were really picking up, and you and I have discussed, and I've talked with others in here about how we're really kind of lagging behind other big cities. So it started to look like we were really getting our wind in April and May, but slowed down a bit in June. In Chicago, sales were only up. Were basically flat. They were up less than 0.5%, and in the suburbs up about 2%. Prices still up in the 4% range for the month for June over the year before, which is good, but we were having price increases in the 7-8% range. So nobody's saying it's a bad thing. I'm not here to say, but it does appear to be a little bit of a slowdown. June is not typically when we start to slow down for fall.
Sure. And so why is that Chicago is a little behind other major cities?
Well, we had real bad job creation after the unemployment depths. We had a really bad unemployment depth. We had a very high foreclosure rate, and we have some instability in governmental finance.
You don't say. A little bit.
Yeah, just a bit. So it's taken a, you know, we're nearly 10 years from the beginning of the bust. We're Chicago prices peaked at the end of the summer of 2006. So we're coming up on 10 years. Many cities have that completely in their rearview mirror. We don't.
I see. Well, there you have it. Well, that's why we turn to you for all this good information.
Yeah, positive, isn't it?
But on that note of home sales and all that, particularly in Chicago, it looks like fewer Chicago homes are in foreclosure. But yeah, there's a little bit of a catch to that.
Yeah, the catch to it is that the foreclosures that are happening are taking longer to get all the way through the pipeline. We're over 900 days it takes in the Chicago area in Illinois for a foreclosure to get through the pipeline. We used to be down in the 650-day range. It's elongating, but that does appear to be a good thing. The fact that there are fewer and they're taking longer suggests to experts that the problem really is that the hard cases are the ones we're working on now. The court system, you know, the lenders pushed through all the ones they could get through quickly. Obviously, they had a financial incentive to do so. But the ones that take longer, the more complicated files are the larger portion of the pipeline now. So it may be a good sign. If we see that the number continues to drop and then the length of time drops, then we'll start to see the end of that pipeline. Once again, other metropolitan areas are already several steps ahead of us.
That is really interesting how we are not really necessarily keeping up with the rest of the nation, for better or worse.
We're not. And you know, one of the problems is if this slowdown that we're seeing, you know, people were seeing a slowdown in San Francisco and Denver a couple of months ago, if it becomes big, and I'm not saying it will or that it should, we don't have as much underneath us at that point to whittle away. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you and I have discussed in the really hot neighborhoods on the lakefront, essentially in the city and a little bit of the North Shore, things are going really well. And prices have been going up and sales have been happening in other parts of the region. But if you bought your house before 2006, you may still be below what you paid. Mm-hmm. And most people don't expect to hold on to a house for over 10 years and have it not perform as an investment.
Definitely. And so speaking of neighborhoods that are possibly doing well, but seeing lots of changes kind of near the lake, and that is around Old Town.
Yeah.
There's an interesting case there about, there's a tiny, tiny little church there that there was some chatter about having it go condo.
Yeah.
And that has been That's nixed. That's out.
Yeah, you know, it's the Herman Baptist Church, which has been in the building since 1904. They're right across, they're at 1764 North Clark. They're right across the street from that Historical Society parking garage, basically, but across the street from the park. They've been trying to sell since 2012, and the situation is they're on a relatively small lot. It would almost certainly go residential because of lots of factors.
And it's surrounded by all those high-rises.
Yeah, they're surrounded on three sides by the property of another condo building. Behind them, the condo building is a high rise. Next to them on one side, it's a mid rise. And next to them on the other side is that building's driveway. So they're sitting essentially in the U shape of that building's property. And there have been other proposals to build condos or to build residential on that site. A proposal came along this spring to put a slender tower essentially above the driveway of that building. It would have blocked few, but still would have blocked some of the condos in the building. And the condo board said, yeah, no. So this church, which at one point was for sale for $8 million, in December was for sale for $3 point something, and the developer who wanted to build this condo tower was offering more than that, as well as financial incentives to the condo building, has backed out. Now they're coming back on the market at $4 million, and one of the things is this congregation, which has been in this building since 1904, the building dates to sometime in the 19th century, they want to get to the west side, they want to get to the south side, they want to get to a place that is less expensive, where they can have parking, where their congregation has more access, and where they can minister to the community more. But they can't do it without some sale proceeds from this church building, and they can't get the church building sold.
So they're kind of stuck.
They're stuck. Yeah, but, you know, the condo building also has an issue. I mean, you know, do you get to build in front of our view? You don't have a legal right to a view, but this building, you know, has had this view since it was built in the 70s.
Right. It is so interesting. People get so wound up about the view.
Yeah.
And that, as you said, you don't have a legal right to a view. It can happen. I've been in that situation where, oh, there's a building going up. I kind of think it's because of the view. Oh, well, I
used to
suck
love
it up.
This. Exactly. Right. Well, I will say, though, to be fair, the representative of that building did say it's not about the view. It's about the neighborhood looking too crowded if you build another 12-story building in it.
Which is potentially fair. I mean, it is a tiny, tiny, tiny.
Think of a typical house lot in Chicago. That's about 1.5 lots for a house. Lots that you would see a house built on in almost any neighborhood. It's
right.
A pretty small space.
Well, we will keep turning to you at chicagobusiness.com for this and other stuff and keeping us updated on all this and the fate of this tiny, tiny little church over in Old Town.
I think it will turn a couple more times before we have an end to that story.
As long as it doesn't become a spire thing where it's a hole in the ground for a long time and nothing happens and then nothing and then more holes in the ground, as long as it doesn't turn into that,
we'll
be okay. All right. Dennis Rodkin, residential real estate reporter for Crane's Chicago Business. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks, Amy.
WGN, Amy Guth in for Steve Bertrand today on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. Still lots to do. Today on the show, we are talking with our good friend, Ian Scherr from CNET, we're always happy to have him on the phone with us, always happy to have him visit us because he always brings us such wonderful information about everything going on in the technology world. And one story that I'm sure you've seen that I know I have followed with great interest is all about a particular user, a notorious user, getting banned from Twitter. This guy, he's self-described as the most famous supervillain on the internet. That's how he calls him. That's what he says about himself. But he was sending some really unsettling messages to Leslie Jones, who is on SNL and who is one of the stars of the new Ghostbusters film. And he has been banned from Twitter, and it's created a really interesting conversation around kind of the right to say things versus the responsibility for saying them and what Twitter's obligation is to deal with hate speech on its platform. So here to talk about that with us is our good friend Ian. Hi, Ian.
Hi, how are you doing?
Great, great. Good to hear from you and good to have you on the program as ever. So talk to us about the situation because I have been following it and I think it is really, really interesting the many kind of satellite conversations that it's brought up just in that idea that, you know, there is indeed we have the right to say anything we want, but there is responsibility for you know, we often don't talk about the responsibility part of that and being responsible for our words.
Well, I think there's a lot of things going on here, right? First off is that the freedom of speech through the Constitution only applies to the government, and they can't stop us from saying things. But private companies can pretty much do whatever they want, which is where we are running up against this, right, is that Twitter created a platform. They created the social network that now more than 300 million people use. And they're starting to actually control what you can say on it. And so you've got that going on. And then you've got this conservative, I guess, provocateur is the best term for him. His name is Milo Yiannopoulos. He's an editor over at Breitbart, which is a conservative news site. And he has used Twitter to great effect to rally tens of thousands of people to make very dramatic moves in terms of conservative causes. And a lot of it tends to be around the idea of issues around feminism, issues around gay marriage, issues around a lot of what conservatives tend to get riled up about. And so you end up with something like Leslie Jones, this comedian who is black and part of SNL and Ghostbusters. And Ghostbusters was one of the most it was one of the most polarizing films of the year, I think, because a lot of people were upset that it was an all-female cast. And he inspired them to all go and attack her on Twitter. And she was so upset by it that she actually ended up shutting down her account. And she, but before she did that, she retweeted a bunch of the really nasty stuff that I'm not going to repeat on the radio. And Twitter decided, okay, that's it. We've had enough. And they banned him. And it's become this huge lightning rod of conversation around the issues of free speech. How far does it go? And what is Twitter's responsibility in all of this?
Indeed. And I think it's really interesting because with so many things that come up that are just so very polarizing on social media, particularly on Twitter, things tend to just kind of die off. They just kind of go away without a resolution too often. And this is very interesting because it, in fact, had a, you know, Twitter taking a step in the process.
Yeah. And it's a dramatic step. And I think it's something that a lot of people maybe weren't even expecting them to do. And it's interesting, too, because it raises all these questions about Twitter has always kind of fancied itself as this home for free speech. And it's where the Arab Spring happened and all of these things. And so can Twitter be this place where political dissent happens and where the town square really lights up? And also be a place that's safe. And that's a really hard question to answer because free speech has a lot of nasty parts to it. And that's what Twitter's running up against. And, you know, do we want people, when you're thinking about can Twitter grow, can it become more influential? You know, it's now a fraction of the size of Facebook. Can it become more than that? You ask those questions and you think, okay, I'm going to try out Twitter for the first time. I go on there and I see people just trading racist barbs and being mean to one another and calling themselves awful names. And I think, oh my gosh, I don't want to be there. And so there are all these issues that Twitter has to deal with that they're really being forced to deal with now that they've become so large and such a part of the media landscape.
Yeah, it is interesting. So I encourage everybody, like, keep an eye on the story because I think it'll be really interesting to see how it unfolds. I think there will be other steps involved. I think there will be more to it by the time it's all said and done. Other things in the technology world that are really interesting and certainly catching a lot of attention. This Pokemon Go, we can't stop talking about Pokemon Go. But interestingly, Nintendo's value has absolutely gone through the roof ever since Pokemon Go was released.
Yeah, it's doing really well. And, of course, remember, value is something that Wall Street assigns to a company. It doesn't actually have anything to do with real life or reality in any way. But the bettors on Wall Street say that they are really impressed with Nintendo and how it's done. They're the company, by the way, that kind of controls Pokemon as a game franchise. And they have actually doubled its value. I read somewhere that it's now being valued more than Sony, which some people might laugh at when you consider Sony's this big electronics conglomerate and Nintendo's just a video game company. But it's really indicated that people are very impressed by what this game has been able to do. And over the last few years, I don't know if you've remembered playing a Nintendo Wii 10 years ago, but ever since that thing came out, they've really struggled to actually be able to draw people in It was really successful for a little while, and then they just kind of lost that steam. And as a company that really focuses on families and casual video games and kind of the more fun aspect of games, it's been really hard to watch them struggle in the market. And so this has been a surprise. It's been very successful for them so far. It's one of the top games ever. And so Wall Street's responding. They're saying, great, show us more, right? And that adds a little more pressure to Nintendo, obviously, but it indicates that they really have a lot of faith in this company, at least for now.
It's interesting, and I've been seeing people walking around with their phones out looking for the Pokemon, hunting them. And what I'm interested in is what we can use this technology for, you know, for other applications. I think there's probably a huge fitness application we could do something with. It's not necessarily Pokemon related, but you know, this idea of, you know, because a lot of people are suddenly out moving around that were not previously.
They are. So. Yeah, and I've actually heard various video game reviewers telling me that they've lost a little weight thanks to Pokemon. you know, the interesting thing is Nintendo actually has a history with fitness. Mm-hmm. You know, they created this game called Wii Fit a long time ago that kind of was right at the same time that yoga was starting to get really popular in the United States and mainstream a little more. And so they were able to catch on to that vibe. And again, it's one of those things about Nintendo is that this company, because they focus on family friendly, and you know, it's not just shooting games all the time. Mm-hmm. They really have really kind of tried to embrace these types of trends, and we'll see where this goes. I mean, the other thing about this game, as we've written about on CNET, is that it also uses technologies that are very much on the bleeding edge here. This stuff like augmented reality, where you take an image of the real world and then you overlay a computer on top of it. So, for example, I've got my phone camera. I'm looking around, and suddenly a Pokemon pops up. That stuff that we're going to see more and more of coming out of the tech industry. Microsoft is building a pair of glasses that actually do this, that will put like your calendar in front of you and stuff like that. So we're going to see more and more of this happening. And Nintendo was able to make it very approachable and also pretty fun. And that's why it's been so successful.
Definitely. All right. Ian Schur, thanks so much for being with us. Everybody, head to CNET to check out these stories and plenty, plenty more. Always nice talking with you, Ian. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
All right, my friends, we're going to take a little break, get you to news, and come back with more Wintrust Business Lunch here on 720 WGN. Hi, it's Amy Guth in for Steve Bertrand today on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us and spending part of your work day with me. I am most grateful to you for that. Next up on the show, we have Elise Glink. You know her. You've heard from her here on this station many, many times before. She is the Money Morning Marketing Podcaster, and you can follow her on Twitter. She's at Glink, or go to bestmoneymoves.com. Hi, Elise. How are you?
Hi, Amy. Doing great. You?
Great. Great to hear from you, as ever. So you have some information for us today about live streaming, which I think is very interesting because those of us in the tech space have been, have been involved with live streaming for a couple of years now, but it seems like right now it's really starting to reach this critical mass of users.
Well, it's interesting because it's the early adopters, right? The tech people who do it and younger people, millennials, and even younger than millennials. And the demand or the expectation from them is that your video is on all the time. Excuse me, I have a little bit of a cold today. And so when the video is on, you're expecting to then interact with it on a live basis. And so what's happened is companies like Periscope and Facebook and, you know, Snapchat, which is what every, you know, under 25-year-old is using for absolutely everything these days, they're always the first to glom onto these things, and then businesses come along later. But when you're doing live streaming, which basically means you're holding up your phone and it's all live, you've got to be thinking about it ahead of time.
Definitely. And I think that's where a lot of brands and professionals kind of get a little sideways with it, because if there's the expectation to be using a platform or a practice, I think there's pressure to be, oh, I got to do this. But then I think if you don't have a strategy attached to that, it can get a little sideways and just not be particularly effective, if not straight up detrimental.
Right. I mean, you can really make a bad mistake. And then that, you know, it's like anything, right? One bad word of mouth is worth like 4,000 good things that people say about you and your company. So, I go back to, and strategy is a great word for it. But thinking about who you're actually aiming for, you know, before you adopt any new social media platform, are you actually optimizing everything that you already have in hand? And how do you understand how this is going to change things? So what are you aiming for? What goals are you trying to achieve? What are you willing to spend to get there? So, for example, Red Bull is now, I think they're using, I want to say Facebook Live, but it might be Periscope. I think it's Periscope. And what Red Bull is doing, they've set up a Periscope account for each of their countries. They spend money to go on these wild rides. Like, they'll put, you know, a camera on somebody's head and take them down the side of a mountain or through a Category 5 whitewater rafting trip. They're trying to get you to experience what they think you will feel if they just drink, if you drink Red Bull, you drink their product. So they're trying to find other ways to communicate that. Live video streaming works really well. Martha Stewart has been doing it with Facebook Live, where she says it's a lot less expensive than doing regular video, right? And she's able to interact with some of the people, but only 1,500 people are watching Martha Stewart do her show on live stream. So is it worth it? And Facebook is not making it very easy for advertisers right now. So what does that say about your return on investment? And that's the kind of stuff I want you to think through ahead of time so that you are understanding what you're willing to spend, what you're going to achieve, what you're aiming for, what the goals are. How is this going to ripple through all of the social media that you're already doing?
Definitely. And it so much reminds me of the conversation when social media was new and a lot of brands were hesitant, at least at an executive level, to buy into it because they didn't understand the value yet. They didn't necessarily have those kind of metrics they could reflect back. But, you know, the brands that I saw do really well, especially once we started getting into visual spaces with photo sharing, with Pinterest, with Instagram, things like that, were the ones that visually displayed their brand and customer values. I mean, Whole Foods comes to mind because they didn't put, their products on Pinterest. They, in fact, put, much like Red Bull is doing with this sense of adventure they want to convey, you know, they put things like, here are these beautiful gardens and here are these, food purveyors in exotic, beautiful places. And they kind of gave a sense of that lifestyle that they wanted to convey, which seems like what the brands who are succeeding with live streaming, it seems like they're tapping into that as well.
Well, they're also tapping into whether their audience that they've targeted has questions back. So live streaming is great because it allows you to interact on a real-time basis. It's a little bit like mixing live radio, like we're doing if you started to take calls, and live TV, but kind of the best of both worlds where it's truly live as opposed to programmed or pre-planned or, you know, somebody fake calls in or it's taped ahead of time. So understanding why that would be valuable to your business is really cool. And then being creative with it and fun is also important. And then you get to the metrics, like, so how many people are watching? How many people had converted, if that's what you're looking at? How long do they stay? What point do they leave? Blah, blah, blah. And you got to figure out what you're measuring. And then finally, because it's all about this, did you actually get some business out of it? Or did you make your customers happier? Whatever you set out to achieve, did you get partway there? Did you figure out while you were doing it how to get a little bit further ahead the next time?
Yeah, it is really interesting, and I think it'll be a topic that we'll see more and more in those business conversations for sure. I think going back to Snapchat for a minute, it's really interesting because I saw a real shift when people kind of dismissed it as, well, it's younger millennials and then Generation Z, the generation below them, younger than them. It's mostly that user base. And then suddenly we saw major media companies putting Snapchat-only publications on that platform in the Discover tab, and it really shifted, and suddenly I think brands went, oh wait, we better pay attention to this, we better really take this very seriously, and immediately we saw that reflected back once Snapchat had that support from brands. They started that tab looked a lot different and a lot more professional, and I think people started taking it a lot more seriously. It became this interesting cycle.
Well, think about how Snapchat has pivoted, right? Because they started out with these instantaneous photos you could only see live, and then they supposedly disappeared forever. At least that's what our kids told us when we told our kids, yeah, that doesn't happen, and truly, it doesn't. Then it moved to, no, now you can capture those images, and we saw that for pros and, you know, con reasons in other areas, mostly dealing with criminal cases, and now you've got Snapchat stories. Mm-hmm. So you're able to build those things together. I do want to point out that Facebook Live got a big boost recently, and very sadly, with the shooting in Chicago where this guy, I think it was on the southwest side, was basically Facebook Living to whatever and all of a sudden got shot and he died. That sort of thing is happening, and we're seeing that a lot of the streaming is being done for news value purposes by what we used to call citizen journalists, and that was like, 4 minutes ago. But when this all started, people who are actually contributing, who are on the streets and actually capturing those moments, and I think the most effective ways of using it personally, not necessarily for business, but when you're in a situation like that, that you want to immediately broadcast and you can't get out. We saw it with the Republicans locking down in Congress. They were Facebook Living what was going on after Paul Ryan had shut everything down from the outside. And so this was a way for the public to get in and actually see what was or was not working inside Congress. So as long as we're seeing that, it's raising the awareness of live stream and the possibilities, and those will be applicable lessons for anybody in business.
Definitely. You know, I'm glad you brought that part up because I think it is very, very interesting how live streaming has changed the role of the bystander so much. I mean, we saw this in Ferguson when before any journalist could get into Ferguson, we saw people live streaming exactly what was happening right there on the ground, and we were able to see the events unfold. And then, as you said, it has played a big role in police community relations conversations, which I think is really, really interesting. So many applications to live streaming, and I think we're going to see more and more of it with professional applications with brands. So Elise Link, thanks so much for being with us today and for breaking it all down for us.
Anytime, Amy. Thank you.
You bet. And everybody, go follow her on Twitter. She's at Glink, or you can go to bestmoneymoves.com. All right, my friends. So we're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we'll get you to traffic and news and all that good stuff in just a bit on 720 WGN. Amy Guth in for Steve Bertrand today on the Wintrust Business Lunch. My friends, I am so darn excited about our next guest because this is a really, really interesting product that I want you to all listen up, think about, take note. This is super cool. We are talking now with Aaron Easterly, who is the CEO of Rover.com. If you're not familiar with Rover, you've probably heard me mention it somewhere on the station because I've been sort of in shorthand calling it like Uber for puppies because that's what we do. We say everything is the Uber for something. But here to talk about this product and service is Aaron. Hi, Aaron. Welcome to the program.
Oh, well, thank you for having me. Nice to be here.
I'm so happy to meet you. I have personally used this product, and I think it is super interesting, and what a great idea. It is essentially, you go on there, and people can either create a profile as a pet owner or as a pet sitter. But interestingly, and unfortunately, this came from originally a not great situation is how you came up with the idea for this.
Yeah, we had three co-founders of the company. One of our co-founders, Greg, had a horrible experience at what was supposedly a high-end kennel. His dog got injured and was very expensive. That combined with the fact that his youngest daughter said that she would be willing to pay people money if she could sit their dogs, you know, light bulb went off in his head. He started talking with me about it, and the light bulb went off in my head when it dawned on me that I had never used a kennel, despite having my Pomeranian for about 10 years at the time. So I was like, wow, I bet this market could be a lot bigger than people think it is if the majority of people have never used a kennel.
Right. And so then you went to the 2011 Startup Weekend in Seattle, and you won top prize. And from there, tell us about the evolution of Rover.
So after that weekend, we started to incubate the company inside an investment firm in Seattle, a company called Madrona. We built a beta version that we launched just to friends and family in Seattle. We launched it in December of 2011. It took off really quickly, so we launched Portland and New York soon thereafter. And then after the first couple markets, we're like, wow, like
this actually
really
works.
Exciting. And let's just open up nationwide and see what happens. And we opened it up nationwide and have been nationwide ever since.
And now you have nearly 60,000 pet people and pet sitters and walkers and all that. You have lots and lots of people using this service. I think it is very interesting. I'll tell you personally, the reason I used it, I lost my pet and I travel too much. And I was like, well, I'm not in a position to get another pet yet, but I miss having a little buddy around. And so I became a pet sitter because I work from home many days. And when I do, I put in my schedule. It's really simple. I like made my profile, put in my schedule. And sure enough, I've not only had adorable puppies in my house, hanging out, but I've made friends around the neighborhood with, because I've built those relationships with people. So I think this is such a fascinating service. And what's on the horizon for Rover?
So you're aware, we have 60,000 people just in the Chicago area in terms of members on the platform.
Yes, I misspoke.
Yeah. So we recently just launched a handful of new services, including dog walking, in-home daycare, and drop-by visits for when you're out of town. And those have taken off. Actually, Chicago is one of our best dog walking markets. That offering has been basically in beta mode, test mode, and we're now the nation's largest dog walking company as well. So that's really exciting for a beta.
Definitely. And I think a lot of people initially think it is about dog walking, even though that's a beta thing. I think people just hear that and they go, oh, it's for dog walking. No. Puppies come to your house.
For us, the overnight care portion of the market, so when dog owners traveled away from home, was the most underserved part of the entire pet industry. It turns out only about 8% of the time that dog owners travel away from home do they use a commercial solution, because for most dog owners, the idea of taking their dog and putting their dog in a cage is the emotional equivalent of taking a child to an orphanage.
Yeah.
So most people don't use kennels. So for us, we looked at the overnight care market as the biggest opportunity, and then other services followed.
How very interesting. And so what are you, as you had gone into new markets and as you entered Chicago, are you noticing that each, what am I trying to say here? Does each city kind of have a flair for a different type of service on the app?
Well, there are definitely different dynamics in every city. Cities tend to mature, and what we mean by that is as we get more sitters and there's a lot more reviews on the side and a lot more word of mouth, the growth really accelerates in markets once they get the critical mass, and Chicago was no different in that sense. But there are also other interesting dynamics based on city geography. And how big is the downtown corridor relative to the outlying neighborhoods really changes the dynamics of how cities grow, and also changes everything from people's willingness to travel what choices they make when choosing their pet sitter.
It's so very interesting. And what do you see the very best sitters doing when they have their, because everybody gets a rating on there. And who are those star sitters, and what have they done to make themselves so?
Well, there's a lot of things Rover does even before a sitter is approved to appear on the platform, but putting that aside for a second, the best sitters, it's really about them wanting to understand your dog and your dog's needs, not what they offer as a sitter. One of the things that we see that's unique about Rover versus any more traditional commercial offering is the mass personalization. And so sitters that have meet and greets, get to know your dog's needs. Is he or she anxious when you're away? Does he or she have eating control problems? Does he or she have a need to sleep in the bed at night? So the sitters that are most successful, it's about trying to understand how to tailor their offering to your pet, not the other way around. The second thing that we see is that sitters that are most successful just do a great job with during the stay communication. So they send photo updates, video updates. If they have any questions, they're in communication. And the technology platform actually takes those photos and turns them into a music video at the end of the stay.
I was going to say, that was such a fun surprise that there's a platform, it's built into the platform that you can communicate with the pet parent during the stay. So you can, send them photos of their puppy being very cute and all that. But at the end of it, it is turned into a little music video of the puppy. It's really cute.
Yeah, it's a fun little surprise that also then helps improve our awareness and gives value for the sitters and the owners.
Definitely. Well, thank you so much, Aaron Easterly, CEO of Rover.com. Thanks so much for being with us today. Everybody, head to Rover.com and check this out, whether you are someone who wants to pet sit or someone who has a pet that needs sitting. Check it out. It is a very fun idea. And, you know, dogs are fun. Everybody loves puppies.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Thanks so much, Aaron. Take care. All right, my friends, we're going to take a little break and get you to news and be back in just a bit on 720 WGN.